Highway to Health, creating healthy, safe and thriving workplaces in transport. Amanda Sudowski, sorry I've got that wrong already, is a physiotherapist and healthy workplace advisor within the Employer Risk Services at Return to Work SA. Please welcome Amanda.
All right. Thank you everyone for coming. I have woken up a little croaky, so I don't usually sound like this, but I'll see how I go. All right. So I just want to start by acknowledging that where I work, Return to Work SA, is on the lands of the Kaurna people and just pay respects to any elders past, present or emerging. And what I'm hoping to cover today is some of the health outcomes that we see in the transport sector, both Australia-wide and then within our Return to Work scheme. Some of the factors that impact these health outcomes, what is currently being done about it, and then what we're trying to do differently at Return to Work SA. So in terms of health outcomes for truck drivers in particular in the transport sector, they do have worse health outcomes than the general public. And a lot of this information comes from some research that Monash University did a few years ago, where they surveyed and interviewed a whole bunch of truck drivers Australia-wide. And one of the most concerning findings was the sheer number of chronic health conditions that truck drivers have compared to the general population. So what you can see at the top of this graph is that truck drivers in the dark blue are far less likely to get a clean bill of health than people in the general population, so to have no health conditions. And they are far more likely to have three or more health conditions, so that's at the bottom of the graph, than people in the general population. So around one in three truck drivers will have three or more chronic health conditions. So that's quite a complex health profile. That might mean that they've got chronic low back pain, high blood pressure, and diabetes all happening at the same time. Another thing they asked truck drivers about was their experience of psychological distress. And the findings here were a bit mixed. But when they broke them down by age, they could see that younger truck drivers in the dark blue were far more likely to report severe levels of psychological distress compared to the general population and males in the general population. And it has a kind of inverse relationship as the truck drivers get older. And some of the reasons they think that are behind this are that younger truck drivers are more likely to do short-haul work, and short-haul drivers had higher rates of severe psychological distress. So perhaps working to tighter delivery times and interacting with road users more frequently. Obesity was another question that they asked about. And again, you're probably seeing a trend. Truck drivers were far more likely to be obese than males in the general population and the general population. So more than half of truck drivers fit into that obese category. And they're far less likely to be in that kind of under or normal weight range compared to the general population. And when you pull all of this together and ask truck drivers how they would rate their health, they are far less likely to rate their own health as very good or excellent, so in that bottom bar, and far more likely to rate their own health as poor or fair. Surprisingly, though, we didn't see this trend when you ask them about their workability. So they still think that their workability is really good, even though they are experiencing these health conditions. And that loops back in a bit later. I'll touch on it again. Looking at our scheme in Return to Work SA, employers within the road freight SAIC account for 1.5 thousand employees in our scheme. And our scheme is not huge compared to some other schemes around Australia. We've got around 60,000 registered employers. But these employers account for 1.6 thousand claims with payments in our scheme each year. And we have around 32,000 claims with payments in our scheme each year. So looking at that percentage-wise, they account for around 2.5% of employers in our scheme, around 2% of the remuneration. So lots of those employers are small employers. There's a handful of medium and large. But they account for 5% of our scheme claims and 8% of our scheme costs. So they are overrepresented in terms of what we're seeing with injury. And when we look at injury types, most of the injuries are musculoskeletal in nature, if you use that really kind of broad umbrella of musculoskeletal. So that's 95% of claims that we see. And they're mostly arising from things like body stressing, so climbing in and out of the truck or pulling curtains, moving stock and freight, falls, slips and trips. So again, climbing in and out of the truck. I don't know if anyone here has tried to climb in and out of a truck. It is really hard and quite scary. And then again, being hit by moving objects, which again, they're around lots of objects that move and can hit them. And injury by body location can help us see why these injuries are occurring, and perhaps when we look at return to work performance, why the performance is not so great. We see a lot of trunk or back and neck injuries, lots of shoulders, which if you're climbing in and out of a vehicle can be very difficult or having to steer, and then lots of lower limb injuries as well. Turning to claim cost, and when we look at average claim cost of a claim within this industry compared to the scheme, so transport is in dark blue, scheme is in light blue, we can see some pretty big disparities, particularly with those musculoskeletal claims. So an average kind of low back pain claim in transport is almost twice the cost of a low back pain claim within our scheme. It's nearing the cost of a psychological injury claim, which we all know are really, really expensive. Not good trends there. This data is from FY21 to 23, so these claims have had time to mature in their costs. Our scheme has 2 years of income support and then an additional 12 months of medical expenses. So, yeah, these claims have incurred most of their costs. Looking at claims that are a little younger, again, we tend to see a disparity emerging, but the psychological injury claims are really expensive really early on. So this is something that we're keeping an eye on for emerging claims within this cohort. But on the whole, most of the claims costs are from musculoskeletal things. So 75% of claim costs from this cohort for the last few years have been musculoskeletal in nature. And the psych stuff is increasing. So from FY21 to 23, it accounted for 3% of our claim cost in that cohort. And the last few years, it's doubled to account for 6% of claim costs in that cohort. So going up, and again, something we're keeping an eye on. Trying to tease out the factors that are contributing to these costs is really important so that we can have a bit of an idea of where to intervene. And one of the biggest costs is income support, which is probably the case across most schemes. And when we look at income support durations for the transport cohort, which is on the right-hand side for you, compared to income support duration for the scheme, we can see that transport cohort are much less likely to have a short-term income support duration, so that 0 to 3 months. And again, we know that three-month mark is really important in terms of trajectory of a return to work. And they're far more likely to have the long-term income support. So these graphs will continue to mature because there's only been one and a bit financial years for a lot of these injuries. So I would expect that 12-plus month bar to grow, in particular for the road freight transport cohort. And in terms of return to work rates, these are fully at work rates for both our scheme down the bottom and transport up the top. We can see that that 4 week mark, transport workers are less likely to be fully at work compared to people in the scheme, and they don't really make it up by that 13 week mark. So 1 in 4 is still not fully at work in that road freight kind of transport cohort at 13 weeks. And one of the key reasons for that is that it's just really hard to do graduated schedules in transport. So if someone's job is to drive from Adelaide to Perth, they can't do that 3 hours a day, 3 days a week. Like, that would take them a very long time. And the freight would probably not be any good by the time they got there. So that can be a really big barrier. And finding suitable duties is really difficult as well. So when you add all of this up, Monash Uni did some calculations and they figured out that there were more than 22,000 working years lost in a 10-year period Australia-wide because of work-related injury. So that's obviously not good for the people that are injured, but has massive implications for Australia, considering pretty much everything arrives on the back of a truck. And we all saw during COVID how much that can impact even things like our access to food. So an important problem that we need to address. Unfortunately, truck drivers don't just have worse health outcomes while they are alive, but they have much higher rates of preventable mortality as well. And the Monash Uni research found that truck drivers were 13 times more likely to die at work than the average Australian. And considering truck driving is our most common male occupation, that's a pretty scary thought. Like all of the families whose dads are embarking on a day of work and their risk of not coming home is 13 times more than the average worker. So this is a bit of a wake-up call, I think. And when we look at the ways that truck drivers die at work, it is most common to occur in a fatal crash. Now, there are lots of things that contribute to crashes, but one of the really statistically significant factors was whether or not the driver had three or more chronic health conditions. So that loops back into the impact of their health on their health and safety at work. Even if they feel like they've got good work ability, there are some factors at play there. It also factored into their likelihood of being involved in a near miss, which again is probably quite a stressful incident to be involved in. And again, doesn't just impact the truck driver, but other road users as well, unfortunately. Outside of the workplace, Monash Uni did some data crunching of, life insurance data, to look at other causes of death for truck drivers. And sadly, they saw some really preventable things coming to the top of the list really early on for truck drivers. So things like cardiovascular disease in the green, we don't see that emerging as a leading cause of death for the general population until people are in their 60s. And then when we look at the rates, they're much, much lower. So you can see here that for people in their 40s, it's 1 in 4 truck drivers is dying from cardiovascular disease, and then around 1 in 3 in that 50 to 59 age bracket. In the general population, like I said, it's not emerging until much later, and then the rates are much lower, so around 13 to 16%. So why does this all happen? It can be easy to point to individual things like whether or not they're eating well, exercising, getting enough sleep, or engaging in risky health behaviours like drinking and smoking. And unfortunately, truck drivers have both lower and higher rates of these things than the general population. But we need to look at the causes behind the causes of these factors. And also when we look at interventions, there are some interventions like health coaching that can improve rates of, you know, eating well and exercising. But those interventions have proven very costly to deliver, and the improvements are not sustained beyond the intervention period. So a truck driver might have phone calls with a health coach once a week for 6 weeks, and they can improve things in the short term, but then they're not able to maintain that for the long term. And that's because there are lots of factors against them, essentially. And those factors are things like long working hours. So 85% of truck drivers work more than 40 hours a week, and 40% of them are working more than 60 hours a week. And research from the ILO showed that working more than 55 hours a week was the leading occupational cause of death worldwide a few years ago. And that's through things like increased risk of cardiovascular events and stroke from just the sheer stress of working long hours. We also know that working more than 36 hours for women a week and 39 hours a week for men starts to have negative impacts on our health through a whole bunch of reasons. This is a big problem. And when we think of return to work, if you have someone who is aging, not in the best shape, and has 60 hours as the bar they need to clear to come off of income support, that's a really tough situation. to be in and difficult to navigate. Access to rest stop facilities. So 70% of drivers said that they didn't have adequate facilities for stopping to get something to eat, have a shower, even go to the bathroom. And if you think of trying to be physically active, you might get sweaty. We were just in a talk about heat. And if you have nowhere to shower after that and you're just expected to hop back in your truck and keep going, then it's probably not a good incentive to be physically active while you're out on the road. Like I said, trauma and critical incidents are really common, particularly for truck drivers coming across the scene of an accident. They might be first on scene and that can be obviously quite traumatic for them. Or they might be involved in a vehicle accident or something like that. And then isolation can really play a role as well. So 40% of drivers report that they feel lonely on a weekly basis and that their work hours impact their ability to be social. So to go to those family events and catch up with friends. And if you're working 60 hours and, you know, driving 6 days of the week and then you rest at home one day of the week, then that's really going to impact that support network that you have. Another factor is we just have a really big country. So thinking of where we are in Adelaide, South Australia, drivers might do the trip to Perth. So that will take them a few days to get there. They turn around, they come back, they rest one day and then they go again. Or they head to Melbourne, then up to Sydney and then back and rest one day and then they go again. There are some workplaces that are trialing novel interventions here, like doing trailer swaps, or they'll do two-up driving so that someone can rest while the truck keeps moving. Or some workplaces have purchased houses along the route so that they can stop and cook a meal and have a shower and sleep in a bed. But that's not widespread practice, unfortunately. Looking at age, this is another big contributing factor to some of the outcomes that we see. And this data looks at claim volume by age bracket for our scheme on the left and then road freight transport on the right. And you can see that there is a big, big uptick in claim volume for older workers in the transport sector compared to our general scheme. And this is just pretty much a reflection of the sector. So one in five truck drivers is already past retirement age and continuing to work. And another one in five are within 5 years of retiring. And they will probably also continue to work. Because we need truck drivers. We don't have young people entering the industry because it's not very attractive. They look at all of the kind of things that they will have to cope with and they would just rather pick something else. So work to try and make the industry more attractive is really important as well. Another factor that played in, and we probably heard about it this morning, was whether or not these workers get good value care when they are injured and how this care impacts their likelihood of recovery and return to work. So Monash Uni looked at how likely truck drivers were to be prescribed opioid medications when they were injured and then the impact that this had on their return to work. And they found that truck drivers were more likely than other workers to be prescribed these medications. So 21% or around one in five truck drivers was prescribed an opioid when they were injured at work. And of those workers, one in three were still taking it 2.5 years after their injury. So it was prescribed without any plan of how they were going to come off of that medication. And we see in our scheme that truck drivers tend to receive less, medical treatment. So when we look at the cost of medical treatment in that cohort, it's lower. And it might be because they're just getting prescribed medications and trying to kick on, I suppose. But it was associated with a very big difference in time off work. So for truck drivers that were taking this medication, they had an average of 278 days off of work compared to those that weren't prescribed it, where they had 23 days off of work. And there was no difference in injury type or severity at baseline. So this prescribing had a really big impact. And they think it's because of the way that it impacts or the kind of licensing restrictions. So they can't operate heavy machinery when they're taking these medications, which means they can't participate in a meaningful return to work. So looking at other pain management strategies for truck drivers is really important. But if you, like me, listen to all of these things and your brain just goes like, what on earth are we going to do about all of this? It's so interconnected. And that's not even touching on some of the other regulatory things, like, you know, driving hours and logbooks and all that stuff that plays in. There are a million factors, but it can feel, yeah, like a tangled mess. So what is currently being done about it? Well, within our scheme and probably within most schemes, we just look at ways to cover the costs. So these are the loss ratios for the scheme and for road freight transport for the past few years, and they marry pretty closely. But the rates that are charged are very different. So the scheme, we have an average premium rate of 1.85%, and in road freight it is 7.44%. And employers, every time I go out to chat with one, they ask me, why is my premium so high? It's such a big cost for them, and it's not cheap to run a transport business, and lots of them have really felt the pressure of that in the last few years. Other approaches are driver medicals, which are very good at picking up on problems but not great at actually addressing the problems. And sometimes because the medical is tied to someone's license, then they might be tempted to not be forthcoming with some of the things they are experiencing. They are changing some of the ways they assess for things now, so that that's not so much of a problem. But things like sleep apnea, they would just ask, do you ever fall asleep while driving? And someone would just say, no, I don't. And then they kind of move on. So the risk, it just doesn't get addressed there. They're also really highly regulated. So they've got the NHVR, which has 1,000 conditions that they need to abide by. Again, Safe Work is mostly focused on regulation, and SAPOL focused on regulating them as well. So they really feel the burden of this, and they feel like they just get punished for doing the wrong thing, and then there's no incentive really for them to try and do the right thing, or no time and resources for them to try and do the right thing. At Return to Work SA, we have a small unit called Employer Risk Services, which is where I work, and we go out and meet with employers to help them improve their safety management systems in a consultative way, and also to try and help them improve their injury management systems. And this does work well, but again, it's mostly focused on how do they meet the minimum standards of things that they need to do. And a lot of that other health stuff, it doesn't really come in under the frameworks that we use. And all of this has come together to, unfortunately, result in the sector coming in last place in the Super Friends Thriving Workplace survey pretty much year on year for the last few years. There have been some improvements, but yeah, it's not a sector or industry that's thriving by any means, unfortunately. So, Michael, who is the CEO at Return to Work SA, obviously saw a need to do something about this, and we introduced a Healthy Workplaces program and joined the Healthy Workplaces Collaborative Partnership, which is a partnership in South Australia between ourselves and Safe Work and a public health agency, among other people, to try and shift the focus towards health and how we can make workplaces good places for people to be that actually help them thrive. And my manager, Glenn Fox, thought that transport was an industry that we could really focus on. But when you look at all the problems, it is easy to get overwhelmed. And so we had to try and stratify things. Some things were big, big, bouldery problems that, you know, are based in regulation. We probably couldn't change those. Some of them are rocks, like maybe access to good rest stops, and you might be able to have a few employers band together and do something about that. But then there are a whole heap of other smaller things that we've termed pebbles that employers can just pick up and change, you know, the way that they operate. And so we wanted to create a bunch of tools and resources and support services so that employers could take action and they knew what to do. And they all said they wanted something that was very clear and that they could follow simply instead of trying to hunt down all the information and sort through it, particularly in the health space. There's a lot out there and not all of it is evidence-based. So we want them to put their time and effort into things that work. So we decided to base our interventions on the Healthy Workplace model, which has been slightly adapted from the National Workplace Initiative Mentally Healthy Workplace model, and we just broadened it out to cover all aspects of health, because all aspects of health are interconnected. So the model's pretty simple and employers seem to get it. It has three pillars. There's the protect pillar, which looks at what can the employer do to protect people against harm or ill health. There's the respond pillar, which is what can employers do to respond when people's health is not great, either because of a work-related issue, and that might flow into our scheme, or because of a non-work-related issue and how they can support them there. And then what can employers do to promote the good things about work and give people opportunities to improve their health? And all of this is based on some critical success factors of leadership support, making sure they collaborate with their workers and making sure that they think long term so that their initiatives are sustainable. And this model has some pretty good supporting evidence. In particular, there's good evidence that if workplaces implement this, they can reduce their injuries by up to 50%, and that they can also reduce their workers' compensation costs, which would be great. So we have bundled this framework together into an Industry Champions pilot program that we're running at Return to Work SA. We've got two employers in the program. We had up to 5 spots available, but lots of employers said, great initiative, don't have the time, unfortunately, to engage, which is a good learning. And hopefully with the stories that we get from these two employers, we might be able to get things rolling and moving and evidence to other employers that it's worth participating in. But each of those employers gets $40K in funding to work through the tools and resources that we've created, and it's released in blocks once they've completed a particular activity. And the aim of it is essentially to just try and develop viable, healthy workplace interventions. So we know lots about the problem. We don't actually have a lot of good solutions to the problem yet. And so we really want to make sure that those solutions are developed in partnership with employers so we know that they're actually going to work, and that we take their views and perspectives on board. So the program has 6 steps to it. It's kind of a continuous improvement cycle. There's step 1 of getting the workplace leaders to commit. Step 2 is learning about your workplace, and we created an audit tool that workplaces can use to look at what they've got in place and perhaps what they could put in place. Step 3 is to involve their workers. So there's a worker survey tool to elicit ideas. Then obviously planning and acting, monitoring, reviewing, celebrating. And we are up to here. I was hoping I would have more to share, but we've had some good learnings from those first 3 steps, and hopefully once workplaces start implementing the interventions, we will have more to share. But step 1, essentially we entered into funding agreements with the participating organisations, and they all signed a Healthy Workplace Pledge, which we worked with them to develop. And essentially it's a pledge about going above and beyond the basics of just being compliant to wanting to create a workplace that is really health promoting. So they had either the directors of the company sign this, or in some instances they had the director and like a HSR to show that there's collaboration going on, and then this was distributed amongst the workplace. They also allocated resources, which mostly was people's time, but still important to set that time aside so that people can participate in the activities. And for learning about their workplace, like I said, they completed this Healthy Workplaces self-audit tool, which is based on the Healthy Workplace model. So it has checklists that align with protect, respond, promote, and then the critical success factors. So they could look at what are we doing to make sure that we're protecting our workers? Are there any gaps here? What could we do to address the gaps? And we got some good feedback from workplaces about this tool, and even some of the things they implemented straight away after they completed it. So in particular, there's a worker collaboration section, and one of the employers said that they essentially weren't collaborating with their workers at all, and so that prompted them to actually talk with their workers about things. So they're about to purchase a whole heap of new trucks and equipment And they were like, maybe we'll ask our workers what they think about these trucks. Are they going to meet their needs or should we purchase something different? And they found that really valuable, and hopefully that will reduce risk into the future if the workers have the tools they need. They did this in a working group setting, which they really valued because they were able to get different perspectives about, you know, this part of the business might be doing it really well, but that part's not, and how they could learn from each other. And they also gathered some baseline data around things like absenteeism, productivity, staff turnover, in addition to some work injury data that we have at Return to Work SA. Step three, which is what they're working through at the moment, is about using a tool called the Affirm Toolkit that La Trobe Uni created to survey their workers. And this toolkit essentially asks workers a whole bunch of questions about their work and then asks them if they have ideas for how to improve things. So I'm really keen to see what comes out of this portion. They've done the initial survey, which is the hazard ID survey, and they're moving on to the sources of risk or idea generation part of the survey. And one of the employers held a mental health month event to launch their survey. So they had a little coffee cart and some merch. And as the drivers were coming through for the day, they just got them to fill it out and get a free coffee because they were thinking, how can we reach drivers who are out on the road all the time? But yeah, this is the way that they came up with doing that. The next things are obviously to interpret the survey findings and then go through that evaluation portion of the program and then look at extending it to more people in the industry if it's working well. We've run some concurrent initiatives, so a few workshops on topics that are of interest. We've developed a web page with a whole bunch of information. We have a newsletter that goes out, and then we've tried to collate some other supports and resources so that employers don't have to go hunting for them. They can just come to the one spot and hopefully find information about something that they need. So that is what we're doing at Return to Work SA. Thank you. That's my info if you want.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Amanda. Any questions, please put them through or come up to the mic. Feel free. None yet, but I must admit, I was listening to you and first half, I got real depressed.
I know.
I was sitting there going, thinking, oh, my goodness, we've got to redesign the whole industry. And then as you started talking through the tools, it felt more like it was a cultural reset, a refocus on what was important. And you're still partway through that?
We are, hopefully we'll keep going. It's been slower than I wanted it to be, which probably happens in most of these programs, but you have to move at the speed of the employer and make sure that they're putting things in place that are going to carry on so that, yeah, they can build sustainable frameworks. So, yeah.
I take it one of the real challenges is bringing all the employees, the workers along.
Yes.
Because I should imagine there's quite a cultural resistance to change and admitting that they've got feelings or any other problems.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of bravado in the industry. And when it came to surveying the workers, the employers were quite cautious, I think, and wanted to make sure that they set up what the survey was for. Because they were afraid that people just wouldn't feel comfortable to share their views and ideas. But
is it heavily unionised?
With those people. So part of this was about saying, well, so much of what you can potentially develop with those particular businesses is often not transferable. And what tends to happen is it's a very competitive industry, and you get those who perform well. And if ideally we can develop an evidence base with those who perform well, then the industry association and its own inherent competitive nature drives people to want to do what those who are doing better than them do. And we believe this will be a source of competitive advantage for those who do it. And so the idea is rather almost sort of flipping on its head the traditional model which we've pursued, which is one of identify the poor performers as opposed to actually who can we get who are arguably the better performers who are prepared to show how this can really be done. and let them be the champions within the industry rather than have Return to Work SA out there browbeating them saying, you must do this to get better results. That's the theory.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, Amanda.
Hello, Claire.
For those that don't know, because each state runs differently, so the Safe Work South Australia is a different organisation to Return to Work, so that's my question's on that.
Yep.
Do you engage in this program with Safe Work Australia, or have they kind of chipped into some of the knowledge base here?
Yeah, so with the workshops that we've run for the industry, Safe Work SA have participated in those, which has been really helpful. So they gave some information to the workplaces around what are the kind of common issues or notices that they issue when they go out to see workplaces, because that wasn't information that workplaces were really aware of in terms of, what they could be doing better. But in the broader collaborative partnership, we've had good touch points with Safe Work. So, yeah.
I had two questions. One was the big rocks you had. Can you share a little more information on them?
Yeah.
And also one was about musculoskeletal, because you mentioned that trunk injuries, lower back pain is a big thing. Imagine if you're driving, sitting down 60 hours a week, are there interventions in that setting that can prevent musculoskeletal injury? Or is it just that, like, the sedentary hours kind of need to be lower than 60 per week?
Yeah, probably a combination. And one of the big boulders is the NHVR regulation. So they regulate work hours and they are capped and everyone will work up to the cap. So they're not always well designed for health. That hasn't really been considered in the design of the regulation. And they also don't really, they're not flexible enough for workers to be able to manage their own health and well-being and fatigue. So it's very rigid, the logbook process, which is one of those big boulders. And so sometimes workers will have to keep driving for really long periods of time just to juggle it all and make it work, unfortunately. They're not allowed to just stop when they want. Which if you were starting to feel a bit stiff or sore, you had somewhere you could pull over and hop out and go for a walk, then that would be great. But, yeah, the way it's regulated just doesn't really allow that. In terms of musculoskeletal disorders, one of the things that hasn't really been addressed is the impact of the psychosocial hazards on the development of musculoskeletal disorders. And we know that they have a massive impact. Some research suggests it's about 50-50 in terms of contribution. So the physical aspects of your job and the psychosocial aspects of your job have a similar weighting, whereas we've really only focused on the physical. So actually addressing the psychosocial is important in that instance. But, yeah, sitting, not great for you for long periods of time. And, yeah, they haven't – I don't know how you design truck driving so that people don't sit for long periods of time, unfortunately. But, yeah.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm really glad I attended your talk. I found it very interesting. Unfortunate, but interesting. I feel like I learned this topic a lot from your talk.
Oh, thank you.
This might be a little bit off topic to Return to Work. So the start of it made me really depressed. I wonder if by filtering in truck drivers, we're just capturing a portion of the society who are not as well off or who don't have a lot of resources, because I feel like they don't work 60 hours per week by choice.
Yeah.
So again, this is quite off topic. Do you think if they are better remunerated, it will make the situation better?
Well, that's a very tough question. There is some evidence that the way they are remunerated increases risk. So if they're paid per trip, or by kilometre rather than per hour, then there's more incentive for them to work more. Lots of them do tend to have relatively high average weekly earnings, which contributes to that big income support cost, but it is because that they work a really long time. So, yeah, I think It would be ideal if they could earn a good income working a reasonable number of hours. That would be ideal. But, yeah, that's, again, probably one of those big boulders. How do you factor that into pricing of transporting goods when costs of things are going up? Yeah.
So that's probably the risk that you will extract more valuable.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. So I think... It is, yeah. And I think lots of employers would say, we'd love to. Practically, how do they make that work? I don't know. So, yeah.
Well, we're out of time, so can you join me in thanking Amanda for a very informative...